And now Keith Lockhart is the second longest tenured conductor in the history of the venerable Boston Pops, which was founded in 1885. The Boston Pops Orchestra plays the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls on March 27th. I caught up with Lockhart earlier this morning as he was studying a score in his office in Brookline, Massachusetts. First time in Sioux Falls for you and for the Boston Pops Orchestra?
As far as we can tell, it's the first time that the Boston Pops has appeared in South Dakota, and it is my first professional appearance in South Dakota. I've been through there on the family camping trip about 45 years ago when I was a kid, but I'm really looking forward to coming back, and I hear we've got a tremendous hall to play in.
We look forward to showing you our hall. It's something we're really proud of here in the city and the state. You must just love all kinds of music, looking at your career and your history. Is that just sort of an essential part of who you are?
Well, I think that one of the reasons that the Pops and I hooked up now almost 23 years ago was because, you know, I'm trained in the way that most conductors are, but that I think my view of music is a little bit more wide-angle lens. I've always loved music of all sorts, of Broadway, jazz, world music, all of those things, as well as the kind of meat and potatoes material that a classical musician is trained on. And the Boston Pops is perfect for that, because what we do, and we have done for 130-plus years, is provide to the audience the widest-angle lens view of music.
Mm-hmm. For folks from South Dakota who aren't familiar with the Boston Pops, and I would suspect most are, but give us a background of, you know, 130 years and why did it get started? What's the mission of the orchestra?
Well, the orchestra was founded in 1885, which was 4 years after its parent organization, the Boston Symphony, was founded. There have been 20 conductors over the life of the Boston Pops, but only three since 1930. Arthur Fiedler, whom is the person who is, you know, so indelibly associated with the history of the organization, who really put the orchestra on the map, not just as a regional resource, but really as a national cultural institution. And the Pops was founded quite simply to extend the reach of the Boston Symphony to people who might not consider themselves classical music fans. We call ourselves America's Orchestra because we have a huge following all across the country, and not just in Boston and New England. And it's from people who love music, all sorts of music, not specifically classical in nature, but our focus point, of course, and the center of our repertoire is great music that was originally composed for orchestra.
So let's talk about the legacy of Arthur Fiedler and the great John Williams as well. And then you come along more than 20 years so far and running. What's it like to step onto the podium when that is the history of this organization?
Well, I have the second longest tenure in the history of the organization by quite a bit. John, my illustrious predecessor, perhaps the best-known composer in the world, pretty much everybody knows John Williams, and as a 35-year-old, I had to replace him, which was a little scary at the time. After 23 years, I feel a little bit more confident in the position, and John is still a colleague and an active participant in the life of the Boston Pops. But it was really intimidating. But that having been said, what a great honor and what a great responsibility to be able to continue to, shepherd an organization that means so much to so many people.
How did you overcome that intimidation as a young conductor in your 30s to step into that role fully?
Well, I think I responded by, I don't remember anything that happened in my first two or three seasons. I think I just blocked them out. But I responded by doing what I do, which is conduct orchestras, connect with audiences, and forgetting the fact that I was on the podium of one of the most visible orchestras in the world. And as I said, that has gotten easier over time. But, you know, the mission remains the same, and it's still a thrill after nearly a quarter century to take this great orchestra around the country and play for audiences and connect with them.
This is talk about the model itself. Year-round employment for these musicians, right? And it tours. How does that model sort of feed into community orchestras? We have a great South Dakota Symphony Orchestra that, you know, has a wonderful following here. Do you find that part of your mission is to sort of encourage people to continue after you're gone to seek out those experiences in their own communities?
Well, of course, the Boston Pops is We are fortunate to have the services of some of the best musicians in the world, many of whom grew up and were educated right here in Boston, which has some of the finest conservatories in the country. But I think at the end of the day, our job, especially when we hit the road and play all over the country, is to encourage people's participation in live cultural events. And the live performing arts really, really need passionate advocacy. And what I hope happens is that we go to a place that already has a strong legacy and history of support for the arts, like you're describing there in South Dakota, and that we leave it with people even more excited to go check out the offerings of their local orchestra.
As America's Orchestra, you're also a New England orchestra. How do you make those deep connections in your own community throughout the year with such an aggressive touring schedule?
Well, one of the things, we are here the majority of the time. We perform probably about 100 concerts a year just in the Boston and New England area alone, and including our traditional spring pop season that culminates in the July 4th concert, which is a huge event on a national scale, and a lot of people set their celebrations of July 4th around the activities of the Boston Pops. One of the things that amazed me when I first came to Boston in the mid-90s was that this orchestra here is revered the same way that a great sports team is revered, and we're lucky enough to have both of those here in Boston, that people on the street and cab drivers and people who are, loading the dump truck on the construction site turn around and go, hey, aren't you the conductor of the Boston Pops? Uh-huh. And, that's a wonderful feeling, not just for, personal, self-backpatting, but mostly because it means that this orchestra means something to people really deep into the community.
Let's talk about some of the more serious, things. 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, for example. The orchestra has to respond to that in a way. How do you handle a situation like that?
Well, music is something that provides many things to many people and hits them on emotional levels in various ways. And one of the things that music can do is provide great solace, great unity, a reminder that there is something better out there. I've been the conductor of the Pops through a lot of those moments, not just regionally, but nationally. I was here during the September 11th crisis as well, and then the marathon bombing a couple of years ago. And the Pops is, I think, a community resource that touches people in a way that few other organizations can. We've played at great celebrations, the rededication of the Statue of Liberty and the Super Bowl, and we've also played at moments where people needed to pull together and receive something from us.
It must deeply affect the musicians in the orchestra as well. Tell me about those musicians and some of their background and how they handle some of those challenges.
Well, our musicians come from all over the world, but many of them are full, settled residents of the Boston community, and they have families here, and of course these things affect them the same way that they affect the broader community. The great thing as musicians is that we have a way to respond to it personally. We have a channel through which to pass our emotions, and it's, at the end of the day, though, what distinguishes this orchestra is that it's an incredibly versatile and virtuosic group of musicians that can really play anything in the kind of style that makes it really, really authentic. It's a lot of fun to work with these players, and some of them predate me here in Boston, but more and more we're seeing people on stage who are now young enough to be my kids, which is a little a little frightening, but I guess that's the normal passage of time.
How do you keep them challenged and engaged?
Well, I think the work does that. We do a lot of performances. We have very little time to get things right, and we expect a high degree of excellence coming into the first rehearsal, and we get it.
Mm. You've worked with more than hundreds of guest artists. Ben Folds was just here in Sioux Falls not too long ago. He's on your list. Elvis Costello, others. How do you prepare for all those wide variety of guest artists that you've had?
Well, the job of conducting is pretty much the same, no matter whether you're working with Ben Folds or you're working with Yo-Yo Ma doing the Dvorak Cello Concerto. The job of conducting is to try to get into the mind of the composer, to understand what the little dots on the paper mean, and to try to communicate that in as coherent a way as possible to your orchestra, and then to serve as the intermediary between the composer and the orchestra, and the orchestra and the audience, the orchestra and the soloist. It's a fun job. I've had situations in my career where I've gone from conducting Mahler 6 on one night to conducting all Glenn Miller on the next night, and I love the dichotomy. It really keeps it very fresh for me.
So how do you dig into something like Mahler and find out what those dots on the page, as you say, mean?
Oh, how do you? That's the $64,000 question, and that's what conductors struggle with their entire career. You dig in the same way you do anything else. It's just that the layers lie a lot deeper. And a lot of my time, the unglamorous part of being a conductor is about the hours you spend in your office, where I am now, with a page full of little black dots on it, trying to figure out what they all mean, both what they mean musically and what they mean beyond that.
What are you looking at right now? What's in front of you?
Oh, let's see. Right now I'm looking at some music for an appearance coming up next week with my other orchestra, one of the BBC orchestras in London, a concert of choral spectacular moments with a cinematic focus, including a large chunk of the Prokofiev Alexander Nevsky cantata.
Mm-hmm. Who do you want to play with, or who do you want to bring in with Boston Pops that you haven't been able to get yet? Who's next?
Well, there have been so many that we have succeeded in getting, that becomes a harder and harder question. But I would say I would really love to have a 4th of July experience with Bruce Springsteen, because I think that's about as American as you can get. And we've also never worked with Paul Simon, which is something that I would like to correct. So if he's listening to your program, tell him to call in.
All right, Paul Simon, if you're listening to South Dakota Public Broadcasting, we've got to do
you
it
never
for
know.
You. What do you bring into South Dakota, Keith?
We are bringing a program of music that is certainly very familiar and very central to our repertoire. It's the music of George Gershwin, but it's a little bit of an unusual step for us, because when we tour, we normally kind of bring a kind of variety show, best of the Boston Pops thing, and we bring things from the light classical repertoire and from world music and Broadway and everywhere else. And in this case, we're being very composer-specific, because there's a great story to tell there. It's an American story. It's an immigrant story. It's a rags-to-riches kind of Horatio Alger tale about somebody whom went from being a high school dropout to being the king of Broadway, to, in a brief 13, 14 years after that, writing perhaps the Great American Piano Concerto, the Concerto in F, American in Paris, the Great American Tone Poem, Porgy and Bess, perhaps the Great American Opera, all that in an under 15-year span. And we try to tell that story. We're bringing a wonderful pianist with us by the name of Michael Chertok, who is an amazing pianist on top of somewhat physically resembling George Gershwin, so that's a good plus. He'll be playing the Rhapsody in Blue, but not in the version that most people have heard, the original Paul Whiteman orchestration, kind of smaller, tighter, jazzier sort of writing that Gershwin, I think, would have been very, very familiar with, as well as the variations on I Got Rhythm. And we're bringing two great young singers, Erica Spires and Justin Hopkins, to give us some incredible selections from the Gershwin songbook. Things like Let's Call the Whole Thing Off and The Man I Love and It's Wonderful, all done in unique Boston Pops arrangements that were crafted just for us.
Mm. Keith Lockhart, we look forward to you coming to South Dakota. We hope you have a great time, and we thank you for your time today. We'll let you get back to your little black dots.
We can't wait to get there and meet our friends in South Dakota. Thanks.
The Boston Pops plays Gershwin on Monday, March 27th at 8 p.m. at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. Tickets available online now. That was Boston Pops conductor Keith Lockhart.